We are starting a new chapter in the book of Mark. We're starting Mark chapter 12. We had just gone through Mark chapter 11, where Jesus enters. Oops, where Jesus enters into Jerusalem. We see that at the beginning of Mark chapter 12 or Mark chapter 11, and he enters into Jerusalem. We see that being Sunday. We saw Monday after that, where he curses a fig tree and he flips some tables over. And then we saw Tuesday morning when we see the effect of the cursed fig tree. And when Jesus is basically accosted once he enters into the temple by the leaders there, by the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, asking him, where does he get off? Where does he get this authority to do all the things that he has been doing here lately? Well, today we're going to see Jesus's response to that in a parable. And after that, I don't know if we'll get to any of them today, but after that, there's going to be so many questions that Jesus is fielding, that Jesus is answering. He's questioned so much by so many people after this section here. And we see how he handles these questions here on this particular Tuesday, here in the remainder or in most of the rest of chapter 12. So let us look at Mark chapter 12. You see, I've got the new word cloud for that one. God takes center stage on this particular in this particular word cloud. We also see Lord sent one. Jesus answered, and that's kind of evident, the answers that he provides for the people, all the questions that he has been given, and he answers them right here. We also see vineyard and vine dressers, and I hinted at that this morning. How this vineyard, how the vine dressers are. Well, this parable of the wicked vine dressers is what we're going to be talking about today. And of course, I hinted at that this morning as we were for our morning worship. All right. So let us. Oh, what happened? Is that the right? Yeah. So let's consider this particular thing here on this Tuesday. I see Kathy Holmes and Carol Good are here. Hello, good to see you. All right. So the parable of the wicked vine dressers. I always want to switch those whenever I'm thinking about it. The wicked wine dressers, but it doesn't make any sense. All right. So we're gonna look at this in Mark chapter 12, verses 1. 12. Then he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it, dug a place for the wine vat, and built a tower. And he leased it to vine dressers and went into a far country. Now at vintage time, he sent a servant to the vine dressers that he might receive some of the fruit of the vineyard from the vine dressers. And they took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent them another servant, and at him they threw stones, wounded him in the head, and sent him away shamefully treated. And again he sent another, and him they killed, and many others, beating some and killing some. Therefore, still having one son, his beloved, he also sent him to them last, saying, "They will respect my son." But those vine dressers said among themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him and cast him out of the vineyard. Therefore, what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the vine dressers and give the vineyard to others. Have you not even read this scripture? The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And they sought to lay hands on him, but feared the multitude, for they knew he had spoken the parable against them. So they left him and went away. All right. So that is our reading, our section of scripture that we're going to be looking at today. Let's see. This first one, first point here I want to bring up. Hello, Roses. Good to see you as well. This first point is concerning pronouns and plurals. Just trying to figure out who we're talking about here, who we're talking to, what exactly is going on here. All right. Many of you have Bibles with red letters in them for the words of Jesus. I am one of those. I like that. I think it's easy. Not that there's anything better in those red words than in the words in black. Some might say there is. Others might not. And in some cases, the red letters are certainly good. I like to use them for helping me find things. Oh yeah, Jesus is speaking here, and the rest isn't less any less important than what the red letters are, but it does help me find things, parables and things of that nature. In any event, there are some things that are written here in the black text that I think we need to look into before we consider what is written in red. So first, I think we should consider the audience that Jesus is speaking to. That's very important. Who Jesus is speaking to in this particular thing. It says in the black text, then he began to speak to them in parables. That might not seem like a whole lot, but he uses them in this particular instance. And later in verse 12, they sought to lay hands on him, but they implied feared the multitude. They knew he had spoken the parable against them, and they left him. So who are we talking about here? I mean, in the very next event, in verse 13, it says that they sent to him some of the Pharisees and the Herodians. So who are we talking about there? Who are they, if you will? Well, I think this goes back all the way to chapter 11 and verse 12. As we say, the chief priests, as we said earlier, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders who questioned his authority earlier that morning. They are the ones who Jesus predicted would reject him and kill him, if we remember all the way back in chapter 8, verse 31. And now this particular parable would reveal that he was aware of the plot, and these leaders knew it. He was aware of this particular plot. We see that the leaders were aware of that based on what we see in verse 12 and this particular parable, that he knew that they were attempting to destroy him. But wait, it says that he spoke in parables, plural. So that's another thing we have to consider. It says he spoke to them in parables, but wait, we only see one parable here in the book of Mark. So what are we talking about here? Well, in fact, Matthew records several parables that Jesus taught that particular day in this particular instance. And I have on here all the way from Matthew 21, verse 28, all the way to chapter 22 and verse 14. And also in chapter 25, we see a whole lot of parables that Jesus is teaching here in this particular section that only Mark records, where Mark records only one, let's put it that way. And I think the reason is because it kind of spurs, this is the key parable in this particular section that spurs on the questions and the anger and everything that goes on here. Not that there wasn't much teaching to be had, there certainly was. But this is what spurs them on, people on or the leaders to question Jesus further. And also one more point. It seems that every commentary that I've read on this, they want to point out some parallels with the symbolism present in Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. Of course, I mentioned that this morning. Certainly, the elements of the vineyard, being the Jews and the master being the Lord, are there. And it may have been that Jesus's hearers, what Jesus's hearers had thought of when Jesus began this parable. But again, it's a very different parable, very different illustration here concerning the vineyard, but still a lot of similarities. And so certainly some things to consider. All right, now let's consider the parable itself. The parable itself. All right. So we see this wealthy landowner. He is leasing his field to people to make something of that field. And doing so is not uncommon, or was not uncommon, in Palestine during this particular time. In this parable, this owner had planted a vineyard. He had built a hedge around it, dug a trench for the wine vat, and built a watchtower. The hedge and the tower were built for the protection of the field. We saw again in chapter Isaiah chapter 5 with the tower that it was used as a watchtower. It was used in order to protect the workers and the vineyard itself as well, but especially the workers within it. And it shows the protection. In Isaiah chapter 5, it shows the protection of the Lord. And here it shows the protection of this particular owner. And the owner then decides to hire some people to take care of his vineyard while he is away. Again, not uncommon. These are, of course, stewards and could take a portion, according to the customs of that time. These particular stewards could take a portion of the harvest for themselves as payment. So they can take care of that, and themselves can be taken care of. Then it was time for the harvest, or as the New King James here says, vintage time. Literally, this is the word kairos, which is the right time. At least that's how it was translated for me in my early Greek classes. The appropriate time, the time of fulfillment, if you will, in a particular time. So he sends a servant. He sends servant after servant, really, for his portion of the harvest. He sends people to this particular this owner does sends servant after servant to this particular vineyard so he can collect his portion, what he is owed, because he owns the vineyard and he's allowing these people to work here. The first one is beaten. The second is hit in the head. The third is killed. We note that there is an escalation of terrible treatment from these hired hands, these vine dressers. After they killed one, later servants were still beaten and others killed. Then the owner had what he thought was an ace up his sleeve, at least that's what it appears to me when I read this, that he would send his beloved son, his only son, to them, thinking that they would respect him. Now, there are a couple of confusing elements to this parable that I have in my mind. They might not be confusing to you, but they are to me, and so we'll discuss them. And while I still wonder, well, and while I wonder, rather, excuse me, while I know it, that it's just a parable that's illustrative of what was happening at that particular moment, I still wonder as to the logic of some of their actions, you know, because it's meant to be a parable that, well, yeah, that makes sense, that makes sense, and that makes sense. It should still make some sense, right? Logical sense in its story structure. But there are some questions I have, and you know, we can at least while I'm going through this, and hopefully I can answer those as well. The first one, why do you suppose the owner would think that they would respect his only son after killing many of his other representatives, wounding, maiming them? Why would he respect them? You know, personally, I would want to keep my children far away from that place. If they were to kill my other servants, what would they do to my son? I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Sam? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I would say, first of all, it's a parable, so a parable is always told for a purpose, and the shape of the parable is designed to meet the purpose. When you look at the context of you know, what Jesus is telling and who he's talking to, and obviously the one who owns the vineyard here is God, then all the other servants that came before him were the prophets, right? So he's saying, I've sent you prophets, and you know, how many times in the Old Testament it says, you know, you've killed my prophets and done all these things. So it isn't so much that I think we have to say, hold it, why did this guy send his son? He shouldn't have sent him. Yeah, everybody else got killed. I think it's more of a situation of saying Jesus is telling them something very plain in the form of a parable, that my father has sent you so many people and you've mistreated them, and now he sent me, and you know, you're gonna kill me. I mean, that's the clearest way that I can see it, is that this is very explicitly Jesus telling them exactly what God thinks about all this and what's going to happen.
Okay. Well, and you know, I do know that, you know, this is illustrative of Jesus, at least when we look at the Son who comes and the prophets earlier with the other servants. But you know, it still makes me scratch my head, at least in terms of the story structure and how that works out. And, you know, maybe he really thought, maybe that is something that they would do back then. Maybe they would have respected a particular son, another representative such as that, because then he would have more clout, if you will, than some servant, some other hired hand. So maybe it would have provided some level. It's like the difference between sending a servant and sending a prince. You're much more likely to listen to the prince than you will listen to the another hired hand. So maybe that's the case. Maybe that's what he was thinking in this particular instance. But the second question I have that seems very odd, another question as I read through this particular parable, I have one of the commentators I looked at provide, I think, three possibilities for the answer to this question, and I think he rather settles on one, and I think there might be a combination, but I'll go ahead and get to the question. Why would these vine dressers think that they would inherit this vineyard if they killed the owner's son? It doesn't really make any sense to me, at least just considering all of that, why would they inherit this if the son is killed? Why would the owner allow that to happen? I would likely punish these people or something to the effect that it would be some kind of retribution that he would give to these people, and not just expect them to be to inherit it. So, you know, just a question. What do you think, Sam? Do you think that they have a good reason for this, for believing this?
Well, for sure, if they've taken on everything that the owner could send them, including his son, and were victorious, they might have a belief that they could, you know, just basically abscond. When they basically are absconding with the land already, right? Because they're refusing to send back any produce from the land, and they're killing all the messengers. So I don't think there's a legal inheritance kind of thing going on here. But unless, of course, the owner comes and they kill him too, I guess. There is a couple of things, you know, where Abraham says, you know, I don't have a son, and the one who's going to inherit all of my house is my servant, right? So, you know, there may be some cultural thing about the chief steward inheriting if there's no family member left or something like that, but I don't know. I don't have any details on that.
Well, they have the none of the commentators mentioned that one that I looked at, but they had three possibilities. One, and actually, I think the first one may have referenced it now that I'm looking at it again. They don't reference Abraham specifically. So this first possibility, the son was the final heir because the father was dead. the vine dressers had in mind, since the owner was a foreigner, that they could make arrangements to have the property deeded to themselves. Again, so that particular explanation to me doesn't make much sense, since the owner has kept sending people to collect. So obviously he's not dead. So why would they think that it would go to them? And so, but even so, if Sam is right, then maybe they thought that there was some recourse where they could take it, since they're the ones who are cultivating it, who are attending to it. And later, of course, this particular owner says, "Come and destroy the vine dressers." So his being dead doesn't quite make sense to me. The second possibility, and again, I don't think it makes much sense, but the second possibility, and I present this because maybe it makes sense to you. So conditions in parts of Palestine were in flux from this time up to the destruction of Jerusalem, and these vine dressers believed that they could use the advantage, political unrest, used to their advantage, the political unrest, to maneuver the legal system to deed the vineyard to them. Well, again, that doesn't make sense to me, because then this makes this more topical than and removes the timelessness of this particular parable, and it puts this into a real world situation much more in time with what Jesus is talking about than with the fact that it's a parable. It's a story. It's not meant to be a real event taking place in a real time and place. It should just be familiar to the people at this time. So, I don't know, using the legal system to their advantage like that with the political unrest going on, again, that doesn't seem to fly with me. The third possibility, others apply the insanity of the idea to the irrational character of the Jewish leaders, who are unable to think soberly and sanely about Jesus in the spiritual kingdom when he had been preaching and came to inaugurate, which he had been preaching and came to inaugurate. The commentator sides more with this particular option, the three options that he presents, these three. And I tend to agree that this one makes a little bit more sense. Of these three possibilities, I think the latter one is the most likely. And I'll get to what I really think in a second. But Sam, I want you to chime in here for these three possibilities. Which one do you think makes more sense? The fact that the father was dead and he would go to the servants here, the political unrest, or the irrational ideas that these vine dressers were irrational and didn't quite have the right way of thinking about things. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a fine time to quote my late great brother White, Horace White, who once said in the middle of a discussion like this, the Bible can shed a lot of light on those commentaries. Because I think if you look at the following context, it's clear why Jesus was telling it, right? He said, what do you think the owner is going to do to these guys? So what lesson is he teaching? He's teaching that the ones who have been given the vineyard as stewards and have abused it and have killed everybody, including the son, are going to be severely punished. So that's at least one really strong message coming out of the parable. I mean, the guy's not dead because it says, what do you think the owner's going to do? So that's I don't know. I don't even know how they could hold that one. Jesus obviously isn't talking about, I mean, it's not the point of the parable to talk about, well, maybe he's a foreigner, maybe we should get away with it. And the last one, it's definitely saying that these guys are in trouble and they're not being righteous. They're being wicked. I mean, that's the whole point. You know, it's introduced as they're wicked. So I don't know. I think sometimes when we study parables, you know, we can go too deep, and sometimes we cannot go deep enough, and we have to make a call. And I would say, given what Jesus says right after this, is he said, what do you think the guy's going to do? You know, but that's the message. And what he's doing, he's talking to these guys that you just said. You know, he walked into the mouth of the lion, basically, when he went to Jerusalem. These guys have been trying to kill him his whole ministry. So he's sitting there, knowing that he's talking to these guys who have blood in their eyes, man, who want him dead. And he's being very clear to them about where they stand with God. And I think, even though it's a parable, I'm, who knows? Maybe we could. It would have been interesting to be sitting at the table, at the rabbi's table, and the Pharisees of the Sanhedrin that night as they discuss this. But this is all we've got. This is what the scripture tells us.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that a story needs to make sense. Okay, that's my thought on that. That a story needs to make sense. Even if it's a parable, we can't just say, "Oh, it's only a parable." Because I do think that such stories need to make sense and be logical within themselves. Otherwise, it doesn't really teach any kind of lesson except, well, that doesn't make any sense. And then they move on and don't even consider what the meaning is. Now, many times they did that anyway. We do see that all the way back in Mark chapter 4 when Jesus first starts teaching in parables, at least that we have recorded. But again, they do need to make some kind of logical sense. And so my thought here is that it's a combination of the first two. The combination of the first one and the third one. The second one about the political unrest doesn't make any sense to me at all. So I'm going to leave that one. But I think it's some combination of the first two. I don't think that the owner was dead. Because again, that doesn't make any sense given the fact that he does so much. He sends his servants, he sends his son, he destroys them. I don't think the owner was dead. But it is possible that these vine dressers would try to plead in court that they deserved the vineyard after he does die, since he had no heirs anymore. And also, as some might say, it's so crazy, it might just work, that they were being so irrational concerning this particular thing. So I do think there's some combination between those. And you're right, you know, there is a reason behind what Jesus is saying here. And that should never be ignored. We shouldn't ignore that at all. Because it is the whole reason why he's telling this particular story, why he's telling this particular event. In any event, we do see that these vine dressers, or that their owner, rather, does take matters into his own hands, destroying the vine dressers and allowing other people to fill that role. And boy, that is so powerful. And I really wish the people who believed that the Jews today were still God's chosen people would actually read this parable, because it kind of undercuts everything that they believe with regard to at least with regard to that particular aspect of things. So let's look at the interpretation of this parable. So important to understand. So the meaning was quite apparent to these Jewish leaders, that Jesus didn't need to explain it to them. It says, and they saw to lay hands on him, but feared the multitude, for they knew, in verse 12, he had spoken the parable against them. They knew that it was that what the meaning of this parable was. They knew what the purpose was. And so it was not hidden to them. You know, we read in Mark chapter 4 that the purpose of teaching in parables was to sort of obscure the true meaning of what Jesus was saying to some extent. But here, apparently, they caught wise to what the parables mean. And in this particular case, it was pretty apparent to the Pharisees and the scribes and the chief priests and all these people what this particular parable meant. Throughout the history of the Israelite nation, they have continually rejected the prophets of God. While God has taken care of his people, as we've talked about quite a bit when we were considering the book of Isaiah, God has taken care of his people. They would often beat and kill the servants of God. And of course, we understand that to be the prophets. In Matthew's account, Jesus mentions that that this was certainly the case all the way back from Abel in Genesis chapter 4. All the way from Abel to Zechariah. We see that in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 35. And so I find that fascinating. All the way from Abel to Zechariah. Some prophets were left alone for the most part, like Elisha, and some that God protected, like Daniel. We see Elisha. I don't recall any kind of persecutions that Elisha went through. And Daniel, God protected him, as in the case with the lion's den. He was protected in that instance. But many more had suffered greatly, like Jeremiah. He was put into a dungeon and full of muck, and so he couldn't get out of that, and it was just an awful situation to be in for as long as he was. Isaiah, you know, according to certain things, he was sawn in half. I mean, how awful are the things that these people had gone through? Even John the Baptist, we see, was executed. He was beheaded. All these servants of God had been wounded, had been hurt, had been killed throughout time. And yet the leaders of Israel, again, the wicked vine dressers, they were still out for blood. As Sam said, they were seeing red. And they sought to destroy Jesus, and all the more after they heard this parable. The owner of the vineyard, of course, is God. I think we can understand that, and that makes perfect sense to us. Well, the Son is Jesus. Of course, the Son is now sent. He has been sent, and now they've got to make a choice with regard to what they're going to do to him. In effect, Jesus is predicting his death yet again at the hands of these wicked leaders to their face. Now, as I say, they recognize that it was talking about them. I don't know if they understood that Jesus is the Son in this particular parable, but they do see that they are the subject of it, that it was referring to them. The people of God, of course, is the vineyard itself, and they would be given this vineyard, or the vineyard would be given to others who would take care of it properly. Faithful Jews, not the leaders here who would try to kill Jesus, but faithful Jews, and of course the faithful Gentiles who would be added to the church later. Then we see that Jesus quotes from Psalm 118. Man, we've seen this psalm a lot lately, haven't we? We saw it in chapter 11. We saw it. I'm sure we saw it earlier. I'm trying to remember now, because I think we saw it in Hebrews chapter 1. The idea, this Psalm 118 is quoted quite often in scriptures, and we see it quoted here again with regard to this messianic prophecy. He quotes from Psalm 118, and this further cements the idea that this is Jesus is talking about the Messiah, and so because this is a messianic psalm, we discuss this concerning the triumphant entry. The people were chanting lines from this particular messianic psalm while Jesus was riding into town. We see that in Psalm 118 verses 22 through 26. All right. Jesus is affirming his place as the Messiah, though it may not entirely be clear to the leaders. Now, the meaning of the parable, for the most part, they understand, but there are some aspects they might not fully understand. At the very least, he is applying this parable to himself and this Psalm 118 to himself, and that they are, in fact, rejecting him as this chief cornerstone. And that he would become, again, that chief cornerstone. The Lord had done this as the Lord had cast out the wicked vine dressers. And it was marvelous. It was marvelous that he was willing to do that. All right, now we're going to see the reaction that the leaders had for this particular event. What's going on here? The leader's reaction, the reaction of the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Well, we see that they wanted to kill him. Coming hot off the heels of their discussion on Jesus's authority, they really wanted to have him killed. And ironically, proving Jesus's parable. And you know, they're playing right into it, which is one reason why you might think they might not fully understand what Jesus is talking about here. But you see, the thing is, as we talked about last week, they're cowards. They weren't willing to answer Jesus's question on authority in chapter 11 because of the fear of the people. They feared the people because they considered John to be a prophet. And they're cowards here again, fearing the multitude, fearing these people again. Why? Because Jesus was beloved or beloved by the people. The people loved Jesus, and can you blame them? I mean, he just turned over the tables of the people who were exploiting them. He was healing them. He was teaching great and wonderful things to them, and he was taking care of them. Man, he was a great person. He is a great person, and of course the people. We're glad to hear him. And in fact, we see later in chapter 12, verse 37, and the common people heard him gladly. You know, they loved listening to Jesus. They wanted to be healed by him and to be taken care of by him. And so these leaders cowardly slinked away and tried to find some other means of attack. All right, and we also recall that many of these people were there when he went into the city. They laid down their clothes in the palm branches, palm leaves as he entered into the city just a couple days before. They likely regarded him as the Messiah, and that the people would retaliate if they acted now, if the Pharisees and the leaders acted at this point. So they left, continuing to hatch their plot to kill him. And again, they slinked away. And we'll see their next attempt next time. I don't think we certainly don't have time to get into it. And I'm kind of bummed because this particular section is about render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And the funny thing about that is, you know, we have this election coming up this week. Many of you may have voted early already or voted by mail. You know, for those of you who are planning to vote in person, that's still ahead for you. And so, you know, this is very appropriate for this particular section, but I guess I can talk about it after the tempers have flared a little or have died down a bit. Anyway,